Campus FM presents a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum in conjunction with Fondazione Patrimonio Malti, entitled Oriental Carpets, Their Design and Construction. This talk is delivered by published author and Oriental Carpet expert, Ms. Jennifer Worden.
For this first lecture in a series of talks which Patrimonio intends laying on, also in respect of other collections of Palazzo Falson, it is most encouraging to see such a good attendance, particularly as these lectures will help visitors to the Palazzo understand and appreciate better what they will be viewing. As announced, this evening's lecture is on Oriental Carpets, in which connection it now gives me great pleasure to introduce Jennifer Worden. Jennifer Worden's expertise is extensive and stretches well beyond that of Oriental Carpets. She has a degree in archaeology from Sheffield University and a degree in history and postgraduate certificate in education from London University. She worked briefly in the textile industry in Lancashire, where she comes from, before joining the Victoria and Albert Museum in 1977. She worked for almost 2 years in the National Art Library and then transferred to the textile department, where she specialised in post-1500 textiles and dress from the Middle East and North Africa. She extended this to traditional peasant textiles and dress from the Americas and Europe. Towards the end of her time with the V&A, Jennifer Worden focused on carpets and did a technical analysis of all the Turkish, Persian, Caucasian and Central Asian carpets, as well as selected Chinese and Indian ones. This as senior curator in the Department of Furniture, Textile and Dress at the V&A. She is currently honorary research fellow at the V&A, engaged in cataloguing Persian 19th century textiles and also writing a book about them. Furthermore, Jennifer Worden is the author of a lavish Victoria and Albert publication on Oriental carpets and has co-authored other V&A publications on embroidery and dress from around the world. The foregoing makes for a very impressive CV. I should now pass the word to Jennifer, but not before I ask you to please switch off your mobile phones. I'm sure she has a lot to tell us all about Oriental carpets. Thank you, Jennifer.
First of all, I would like to thank you for coming this evening. Everybody's time is precious, so I'm very honoured that you've given time to come and hear me speak. I'm also aware a lot of you may have had problems with the traffic this evening, so again, I thank you for persevering and for arriving safely. I hope to talk for about 45 minutes. It's always a bit hit and miss. I never know quite what's going to happen. I will be happy at the end to try to answer any questions, but also I warn you, at the end, the very last slide will be my email address. So if you want to make a note of it, if at any time in the future, and I mean any time, you have a query about carpets that, or textiles, that you can't answer, by all means do email me. I may not know the answer, in which case I'll tell you. I don't know. But if I do know, or if I know somebody who does know, I will be very happy to try to solve your problems if you have them. I have one or two business cards with me, but I will put my email address up at the end. Now, it is possible some of you may fall asleep in the next 45 minutes, which is fine. I have no problem. Don't snore. If somebody next to you does snore, just give them a little nudge. And please, as Francesca said, make certain you've turned off your mobile phones, otherwise you will waken the people who have fallen asleep. So, what I'm going to try and do is three sections. The first one, a very, very brief history of carpets from an English point of view, because that's what I know. Then a larger section about the technique of weaving carpets. And then finally, the third section is just looking at some carpets. I know some of you know things about carpets, and I know some of you don't know anything about carpets. So I've tried to pitch it on a general terms, but I hope I give all of you one or two ideas that you haven't thought of before. And then, as I say, if it's something you wish to develop, take a note of my email address, ask me for a business card, and I will be very happy to help in the future. So, can we have the first image? We have the first image. This is the only one where I've actually put the name on, because it's a name you may not be familiar with. It's the Pazaric carpet, and this is the oldest surviving carpet in the world. It dates from about the 5th century BC, and it was found in a frozen tomb in the Altai Mountains in Siberia. And it's now in the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. This is also, I think, the worst slide I have this evening. So rest assured it gets better as it goes on. It's simply, this is the only slide I could find of this carpet. It is, it's a fairly sophisticated carpet. We're talking about something 5th century BC, but this is not primitive in any way. This is already a well-established craft of weaving carpets. What I'd like you to notice is the outer border. I'm going to use this laser pointer carefully, I hasten to say. This border along here has got men on horseback, and I want you to remember that because it will come up in another slide later. Can we have the next, please? And this is a detail of one of the inner borders with beautiful reindeer on them. So this is a sophisticated carpet from a well-established craft. Now, people think it wasn't woven in Central Asia, in Siberia, that it probably came from further west, from Iran, possibly from the Caucasus Mountains, even possibly from Anatolia, from Turkey, and that it was traded along the Silk Route into southern Siberia. Can I have the next? This is, from now on, I think all the carpets, well, except for one, all the carpets I'll show you are from the V&A's collection. This is a fragment from the Silk Road in Central Asia, dated to the 3rd century AD. Just to show you again that although the Pazaric carpet is the only complete carpet to have survived and the oldest one, many, many fragments have been excavated from Egypt, from Iraq, from Iran, and this from Central Asia. So carpets go back a very long way. And this is actually a European carpet from the late 12th century, woven in Germany. And it was used as a wall hanging and not a floor covering. But again, I want to make the point that the technique of knotting carpets was known a long time ago. This shows piety and justice, and it's actually a very long piece. This is about, I'm sorry, I work in imperial measurements, 4.5 feet by 8.5 feet. And this is just a fragment of what has survived from the late 12th century. And it was woven by nuns in a convent in Quedlinburg in Germany. So how did this technique of knotting carpets find its way to Germany and also to Scandinavia in the 12th century? The map shows the Silk Road through the centre of Asia, which is where many of the fragments have been found and where the Pazaric carpet comes from. As I say, fragments have also been found in Iran, Iraq, Egypt, in countries where the climate is hot and dry and textiles survive. So they were probably much more widespread. It's simply they haven't survived because the climatic conditions haven't been good enough. We know that carpets were also being woven in Islamic Spain in the 10th and 11th centuries and were so well known they were being exported from there to Egypt and to what is now Iraq, and also to the Pope's palaces in Rome. It's possible that the nuns in Quedlinburg in Germany in the 12th century learned the technique from nuns in Spain. But the most likely, or the more likely, thing is that the Crusaders brought the technique back to Northern Europe. So you have the Crusaders here in the Holy Land. They go across Anatolia. By taking the Danube River and then the Rhine, they come back to Northern Europe, to Scandinavia. it's not inconceivable that they brought back knotted carpets with them as something exotic. And we think that is the way the technique was transported to Northern Europe. Carpets in Europe have always been expensive and scarce. And in England, the first portrait we have, which includes Turkish carpets, is this one of Henry VIII. He's standing on the carpet, and that's very important. He, by standing on the carpet, is showing his wealth and his status. He can afford to buy something phenomenally expensive and stand on it. And this is his way of saying, look how important I am. His son, Edward VI, also portrayed standing on a Turkish carpet. But the most common way of using a carpet was to put it on a table. And this is a painting from the National Portrait Gallery in London, called, often called the Somerset House Conference. It's dated 1604. And it shows, again, you had to be wealthy to have a carpet, but the most usual thing in Western Europe, you put it on a table. It's far too precious to put on the floor and stand on. Somebody once said to me, if you go along to the National Portrait Gallery and look at this, you will see ink stains on the carpet. And so I'm going to tell this to you. I did, however, go and stood there for quite a long time. I can't see an ink stain on the carpet. But if ever you're in the National Portrait Gallery, go and have a look at this and see if you can find the ink stain. So, in the 16th century, beginning of the 17th century, carpets from Turkey, we didn't have them from Persia because we weren't trading with them. So all the carpets in Western Europe were from Turkey. They were very expensive. Things changed in the 18th century. In the 18th century in England, our empire was expanding. People were more wealthy, and sort of lesser nobility were beginning to build country houses for themselves and then have themselves painted in the reception room of a country house on a Turkish carpet. And this painting is dated 1747, and you can see, like Henry VIII standing on the carpet showing his status, they're being painted with what's important. On the mantelpiece above the fire is blue and white porcelain, either Chinese or Delft from the Netherlands. This is showing their good taste and their wealth, and the Turkish carpet they're sitting on. This painting is slightly earlier, 1742, so it was 5 years earlier. Again, a newly built country house, scientific instruments near the window showing how learned the man is, how modern he is, and the Turkish carpet, pride of place. This is, we are wealthy, we have arrived, we have our country house, we have our carpet. Fine. So this is the 1740s. We've only got to go about 30 years forward and things change dramatically. This is dated 1775. The carpet here is not hand knotted, it isn't Turkish, it's English machine woven carpeting. This was the new thing. And if you look at paintings of interiors from about the 1770s through to the 1850s, you will find it very difficult to find an Oriental carpet in any of them. They are all European-made machine-woven carpets. This was the great fashion at the time. You could order the borders you wanted, the main body of the carpet, you could have the strips sewn together, it could be specially cut out around fireplaces, it could be extended into alcoves. It was a fitted carpet. Nobody wanted Oriental carpets. And when I found this out, it was a great surprise to me. I'd simply assumed Oriental carpets were always there, century after century. Okay, sometimes they're expensive, sometimes they're more affordable, but I thought they were always there. But this is this great gap in not just Western Europe, as Russia as well, that if you look at all the interior paintings, they are, the ones I've seen, machine-woven carpeting. And This one, I tried to find something for Malta and I can't, so this is Italy. This is as close as I can get. This is 1807. The line down the right-hand side is simply, I photographed it from a book, and that's where the page is divided. Machine-woven carpet. Very fashionable. From the clothes that they're wearing, wealthy, fashionable, not an oriental carpet, machine-woven. And so it continues across the whole of Europe. London, Paris, Berlin, Italy, St. Petersburg, Sweden, machine-woven carpeting, till you get to about the 1870s. And then it changes. And all the interiors you look at, they've got oriental carpets all over the place. This meant that in places like the Caucasus and in Iran, there was suddenly a great demand for hand-knotted carpets. And you find in all the countries that produce hand-knotted carpets, round about the 1870s, there are more workshops, it's more organized, there are factories being built because there is this great insatiable demand, not only in Western Europe, but in North America as well. I can't explain why this has happened. It may be it goes hand in hand with the arts and crafts movement. Production in Western Europe was industrial and it was all machine made, and perhaps there was this movement back towards craft work, handmade things. I'd like you just to think for a moment, if I said oriental carpets to you, what are the words that it conjures up? I'm not going to ask any of you to tell me out loud, but it is worth just thinking for a moment. What words does oriental carpets conjure up for you? Right. What I'm going to do now is to begin to talk about the different designs and how they come about. This is a beautiful carpet from the V&A, the Ardebil carpet. It's got a date. It was woven in 1539-1540. And this typifies one type of oriental carpet. Beautiful, graceful, curving designs. And for those of you who don't know, I just want to, just a little vocabulary about carpets. The large area in the middle is called a field of the carpet. And most carpets have really three borders. The wide one is called a main border, and you get a narrow inner border and a narrow outer border. So with most carpets, you have the field, which is a rectangle in the middle, and you have an inner border, a deeper main border, and then an outer border. Sometimes you get lots and lots of borders, but this is the basic design structure of a carpet. This is a classical Persian one because you have a medallion in the middle, and then you get a quarter of the medallion in each corner of the field. That's classic Persian court design. It's called the Ardebil carpet because it came from shrines, a shrine complex in Ardebil. The assumption at the moment from the evidence available is that it was woven in northwest Persia, but you can't say definitely it was woven in Ardebil. Because of its size, it's over 36 feet long, you need substantial financial input. Because there were a pair of them, there were two. If you've got a workshop that's going to weave two carpets of that size, it's got to have a lot of financial backing there. So the probability is it was a court workshop, but nobody knows for certain. But the same elements of that Ardebil design are seen here in this other Persian carpet. You've got a medallion in the centre, you have a quarter of a medallion in each corner of the field, but it's completely different. The lines aren't curving, they are angular. And about 75% of all oriental carpets are woven with these angular designs. Now, both these carpets were Persian, so it's not a matter of a geographical thing. Curving designs are woven in one area and straight angular designs are woven in another. There's something else that's determining whether you do a beautifully curving, graceful pattern or whether you do something slightly more angular and robust. And that is the technique that's being used. It's the type of knot. There are two main types of carpet knots, which I will explain to you. The interesting thing is that way back in the 5th century BC, in the Pasaric tomb, there were carpet fragments found, one using one type of knot, one using the other. So both types of knots go back at least as far as the 5th century BC. I want to talk first about the types of looms used. The type of loom does not affect the type of knot, but it can affect the length of the carpet you're weaving. These are Turkish weavers. Again, it's interesting to note that there are three people weaving one carpet. You tend only to weave the width of a hand span, which I worked out is about 27 inches. Because you don't want to be leaning too far to one side, it's uncomfortable, too far to the other. You weave just where your hands will comfortably go. So you have a second or a third, or in some cases five weavers sitting side by side, weaving the same carpet. On this type of loom, the length of the warp, which runs the length of the carpet, you can see the warp threads at the top here, and they continue down and form a fringe at the bottom. It's a fixed length, and as the carpet grows, you have to raise the bench on which the weavers are sitting. And there is a limit to how long the carpet can be, otherwise your weavers fall off. And you see here little girls outside weaving, so you cannot weave a very, very, very long carpet on this sort of loom. This is a different sort of loom, and I will show you the slide later because there's something else I want to talk to you about. There's a beam at the top of the loom and a beam at the bottom, a roller of wood. And the warp here, instead of being fixed at the top and fixed at the bottom, forms a continuous loop round the bottom, up the back, over the top. So when the weaver has done a bit, she doesn't raise her bench, she sits on the floor, and the whole of the structure of the carpet is pulled down around the bottom roller, and when she's about to finish, the complete carpet will be running up the back of the loom. But again, there's a limit to how long you can weave a carpet. The carpet cannot be longer than the distance around here, but it can be longer than on the fixed loom, because it could be the whole of this length and then up the back. But again, your loom is limiting what you can do. This is a dark slide because it was the interior of a house. Different type of loom. Here, although you can't see it, at the top the warp is wound time and time again around a roller at the top. And the carpet she's woven is being wound round and round and round a roller at the bottom. And this type of loom means you can weave a carpet of incredible length, because the unused warp threads are wound at the top and the carpet that has been woven is round at the bottom. This is the type of loom that most carpets are woven on. And this is certainly the one that commercial carpets are woven on. Wanted just to mention that there is a different type of loom, a horizontal loom. And they tend to be found where people are nomadic, or until recently have been nomadic, because they say it's easier to pack up a horizontal loom and transport it than it is to move a vertical loom. So I just want to put it in to alert you to the fact there are horizontal looms. And what I want to point out here are these two implements here. Wooden handles, but metal teeth, a comb, a beater, and it's got very strong metal teeth. And after every row of knots have been woven and some weft has been passed across, you get hold of one of these beaters and you beat down on the carpet you've just woven as hard as you possibly can. And if you're in a carpet workshop and you hear it, it's going thump, thump, thump. You put a lot of strength into it, but that's how you compact the pile that you've woven and you make this very solid carpet. There are three components to a carpet. The first one is the walk, which I've already mentioned, and they are the threads that run the length of the carpet. So the carpet's on either side of me. The warp is forming the fringe at the top and the bottom. And the warp is held under tension on the loom. And sometimes it's difficult to get even temperature, even tension. If you're working with 1,000, 2,000 threads per carpet, it's very difficult to get an even tension on them. And sometimes when the carpet is completed and cut off the loom, it doesn't lie flat. But that's the first thing is the warp. And the weavers then start to knot the pile. The warp can be wool. Most carpets are wool. It can be cotton. It could be silk. But you have white cotton warp here. Actually, it's white wool warp here. And you can see they're beginning to knot. This is all knotted carpet that's been done. They're beginning to knot individual ones. Sometimes they do it colour by colour. If you get hold of some black thread, you put in the black knots. The important thing to realise is you complete one row of knots at a time. You can't build up an area here. You do one complete row at a time. And this is the back of the same carpet. You can see individual knots there. This is a label just attached to the carpet. Because it was in an exhibition. You can see, I hope, some white threads that are running across, interlacing with the warp. This is the weft. After every row of knots, there is what I call one shoot of weft running across the entire width of the carpet, interlacing in front of one warp thread behind the next, in front of one behind the next. Most carpets have two shoots of weft. Some have more, but this is what creates the fabric of the carpet. You could actually pull out every single knot of an oriental carpet and you would still be left with a woven fabric. It's something I've been dying to do, but nobody will ever let me do it. But you can. You could pull out every single knot and you still have a structure there. And it's the warp with the weft interlacing. These are women weaving a similar carpet to this, and this implement there is the beater with a wooden handle and the very strong metal teeth, and she's just reaching for it because they have completed one whole row of knots. You see the pile is left quite shaggy. Final thing, when the carpet is taken from the loom, somebody who is skilled will cut the pile to an even level. The weavers will just cut it quite roughly as they go along. When you begin a carpet, as you will see on these, you don't begin with a row of knots because they'll fall off, they'll just drop off. You begin with a band of what's called plain weave. And the two carpets here actually have very decorative bands at the bottom. It's not essential. What you need is simply a couple of inches of plain weave, and then you start your row of knots. And you can see the first row of knots, yellow and red, very beautifully here. I will show you the diagrams of the two knots. This is a symmetrical knot. It used to be called a Turkish knot. If you read old books, they may also call it a Giordi's knot. And the problem with calling it Turkish or Giordi's was that everybody had in their mind, it comes from Turkey, therefore all Turkish carpets are woven with this knot. And any carpet I see woven with this knot is Turkish. It isn't as simple as that. So it's now called a symmetrical knot. And it's called symmetrical simply because it goes round one warp thread and round another, and the two ends of the knot come up in the middle. Nice and symmetrical. What you can see on this structure is, after each row of knots, there are two shoots of weft interlacing with the warp. This is a fragment of a carpet in the V&A, and some of the pile has fallen out, and it wasn't me who pulled the knots out. It happened before I went there. But all this area here used to have dark brown pile, and it's fallen out. And what you can see is the white warp running down and dark brown weft interlacing with it. So the weft, the dark brown is the weft, the white is the warp, and you can see all the little knots still there. This is the back of the same carpet. Symmetrical knot. Each one of these bumps is part of a knot, and there are two bumps per knot. Because, if you remember, the knot is tied around two warp threads. So when you look at the back of a carpet like this, each pair is one knot. And if you want to do an analysis, a technical analysis of a carpet, you've got to do it from the back, because from the front you can't really see anything because of the pile. And that's the front of a carpet, and you can't see the warp and you can't see the weft. Now, in theory, every single knot could be a different colour. You're only limited by the fact that you probably can't get thousands and thousands of colours, and what would be the point? It wouldn't make a design. But the theory is each knot can be a different colour. Again, the symmetrical knot, it goes around two warp threads. It's actually quite bulky because it goes around two threads. And that's important. This is the other sort of knot called an asymmetrical knot. And if you see, it only encircles one warp thread and then it goes just under the other. And one end of the knot comes out between that pair of threads and the other one comes out between there. It's asymmetrical. It's actually less bulky, and that's the key. You can get more asymmetrical knots in a given space, say a square inch, than you can with the bulky symmetrical knot. And this is a chart for comparison. On your left-hand side, there is a squared chart, and this is what the bulky symmetrical knot would be like. And on your right-hand side, a square chart, this is what the finer asymmetrical knot would be like, and above, resulting carpets. If you're using the bulky knot, you cannot do the fine, graceful, curving lines that you see in some of the classical Persian carpets. You can only achieve that with a greater density of knots using the asymmetrical one. And that is the crucial thing. If you remember nothing about carpets after this evening, please remember that if you're using the symmetrical knot, it is almost impossible to do one of these beautiful curving, curvilinear, naturalistic carpet designs. So it's not that you don't want to, it's simply that your technique, your tradition, means you can't do it. Now, two carpets to the same scale, 13 centimetres, 15 centimetres, it's running down the edge. This one is a symmetrical knot. It's got 90 knots per square inch. That's not a measurement of quality, it's just a measurement of fineness. 90 knots per square inch, and you can do wonderfully bold, straight and diagonal lines. Fantastic, geometric, abstract, powerful, wonderful. Same scale. This one has got 210 knots per square inch, so that's more than double. And you can define lines, you can do curves, you can make things look more natural, more realistic, simply because you're using the other knot. And it's all a question of your traditions. Beautiful birds, a bit odd looking, but nevertheless, 700 knots per square inch. You can do anything with 700 knots per square inch. And this is 154 knots per square inch. You're more limited. It's not to say it's not beautiful, but it is different because you're using a different technique. Now, I just want to show you some odds and ends, and then I'll show you some more carpets. Sometimes, if you're reading carpet literature, you might come across the phrase, a depressed warp. And I used to work with a lady who didn't really like carpets, and she used to say, oh, I know what the warp feels like if it's depressed. And the depressed warp is simply, it's usually, I think 99.9% of the time, with an asymmetrical knot. And you can see, instead of the knot being on one level, a bit of it has fallen below. I used to think this was accidental, but a weaver told me, no, it's done deliberately, because you can actually increase the number of knots per square inch dramatically. And this is a photograph of just the profile, looking along the length of a carpet. And you can see the warp threads here are definitely forming two layers. Normally in a carpet it wouldn't. The threads would just be side by side. But with a depressed warp, you've actually got them forming two layers. And I just wanted to show you those illustrations in case you've come across the term, or will come across the term, and you're not certain what it means. Sometimes in carpets you've seen odd things happening here. Here there's a wedge of sort of little bits of knots. So here below you've got a complete row of knots going all the way across the carpet, and above you've got complete rows of knots. Here in the middle you've got a sort of one row that only goes part of the way, and another row that sort of joins with the one above. It's a wedge of knots and web. And that's because one side of the carpet was growing slightly faster than the other, and they were trying to even it up. And that's what happens when you get two weavers side by side. They're using these metal cones to beat it down. One's tired, or younger, or just more feeble, and isn't doing it with quite the strength of the other. So one side is growing slightly more than the other. And that sometimes when you see a carpet and the ends, it's not a proper rectangle, one end is slightly longer than the other, it's two weavers using different tension, different pressure when they're beating down the pile. And here they recognised what was going on, quick adjustment, a running adjustment as they were weaving. This is what I think makes carpets exciting, when you can see the weavers actually doing things to compensate for problems. You can also use metal thread in carpets, and if you do, you do not tie knots. It wouldn't work. So what you do is, there's gold thread at the top of this design, silver thread at the bottom. You just weave it with the weft. So you don't tie knots, but you can use metal thread in carpets. Makes them more expensive, much more expensive, but it is possible to do it. And sometimes in carpets, you find that certain colours, I'll use the word corrode, they rot, they fall out, and black is the preeminent one for falling out. And it's because when you're making a black dye, you often use iron. Rusty nails, that sort of thing. And so the chemical in the dye actually starts to rot the fibres. And when you look at a carpet, you may find that the dark brown and the blacks are falling out, or the level of pile is slightly less. I'll be honest about this one. It's a detail from a carpet in the V&A, which we bought, I think in the 1930s or 40s, as a 17th century Turkish carpet. And one of the things, I mean, it had this great provenance with it, it turned out to be a pack of lies. It was woven in Romania only a few years before we bought it. But one of the things that made the curators think it was old was the fact that this black had decayed. But the man who wove it knew that by doing that it would make it look old, and it fooled us, and actually several other museums have been fooled as well. Never. That's one. Now this is a Caucasian carpet from about the 1870s in the V&A, and the black has fallen out, so areas that look slightly bald and slightly blue down here is simply where the black pile has fallen out. I want to change now just to talk about how do weavers know what pattern they're weaving. There are different, you could invent the pattern as you go along, but remember you're inventing not only the field pattern, but the borders. So that's an awful lot to carry in your head if you're creating it as you go along. It's not impossible, but very difficult. Sometimes if the carpet has very small motifs that just repeat, you could almost imagine, yeah, the weaver had an idea and was creating, but it is very difficult. You could copy an old carpet, and I think this is done quite a lot. If you turn it so that you're looking at the back, you see the colours, you see the design. You could work from a drawing. And that's quite, I think that works well if you're doing an angular design. But if you're doing something that is very balanced, curvilinear, I think a drawing would have to be fairly detailed. But a lot of carpets that we see today were worked from drawings. And that's why you find sometimes the proportions change as the carpet grows in a way. So the weaver was quite confident working from the drawing at the bottom bit. But once the bottom bit's woven and the carpet's rolled around that bottom roller, you can't look at it again just to refresh your memory. You're looking at the drawing, and if you did it, interpreted it one way at the lower half of the carpet, you might find yourself interpreting it in a slightly different way at the top, because you can't look back to see what you did earlier. You might change it slightly, you might start using different colours. So when you see a carpet where the top bit doesn't quite reflect the bottom bit, possibly they were working from a drawing. The other thing you can do is work from a squared chart. And if anybody's ever done cross-stitch embroidery, you know exactly what I mean, where each square represents a stitch in cross-stitch, or with a carpet, each square represents a knot. You can do anything if you work with a chart, absolutely anything, because it's all worked out on paper first, the most complex design you can think of, and you can do it because you are simply copying one square on the chart is one knot on your carpet. And this is a slide I showed you earlier. Then we looked at the way the warp was wound in a continuous loop around the beams. Look what she's got there. She's got a chartered design. And that's what she's referring to as she's weaving the carpet. These are modern design schools, design workshops attached to carpet workshops now, where you can see the designs are being chartered out. Now, in the late 19th and in the early 20th century, when charts were used, or where they were used, sometimes a merchant would go to a village where they could weave carpets, may even take all the fibres they needed, all the wool that was needed, and would take the charts for the design and say, I'll come back in 3 months and I'll buy the carpet from you. And in this way, the merchants knew what would sell in the towns, what would sell for export for particular markets, and the weavers sat in their own homes, but all the materials were given to them and the designs were given to them as well. This is a very elaborate curvilinear design, but again, it's being put onto chartered paper, which will then be given to weavers in a workshop. And here you can see weavers actually using sections of the chart for the carpets that they're weaving at the moment. And here, a factory. And you have to call this a factory. Workshop is a nicer word, isn't it? I like to think that carpets are woven in workshops, but some of them, alas, are woven in factories. If you're weaving a carpet in a village, you're usually using whatever wood you can get your hands on to build the loom. It's not always milled timber of equal width. And so if one bit of your loom is thicker than the other, the chances are your carpet might come out slightly, well, less than a perfect rectangle. In the factories, they're either using milled timber of standard thicknesses or scaffolding-type metal pipes. So your carpets then are very regular. The sides are parallel, tops and bottoms are parallel. But I want to look now at some carpets before you all decide I've been talking long enough. Yes, please. This is from a Persian carpet from the 17th century. And it's the angel Gabriel, Archangel Gabriel wearing lipstick. And the halo is silver metal thread and silver down here. The next one, please. And the angel Gabriel, it's the Annunciation, that's Our Lady, the Virgin Mary. And they are two of the designs on an ecclesiastical vestment. This is not a good slide. The colours are not good at all. It's on display in the V&A. It's actually knotted pile. When you look at it, you think it's velvet. It's so fine. Now, when I worked there, it was always behind glass, so I never got my hands on it. So I don't know the knot count, but I would expect it to be about 1,300 per square inch. It looks like velvet. You would swear blind it was velvet. You'd never think this was a knotted pile, exactly like a carpet. It was originally, we believe, semicircular, and although it was woven for the Armenian church, I'll call it a cope. I know it's not the word they use, but I guess most of us would understand what a cope is. And if you see, Our Lady is there, and the Archangel Gabriel is there, so when the priest wore the cope, he would have both of them meeting face-to-face down the front in the Annunciation. And on the back is the crucifixion. And this had to be woven from a chartered design where one square on the chart is one knot. There is no other way you could do this. So using a chart isn't cheating. It was done in this 17th century Persian. I'll call it a carpet. It's the same technique. So it is something that goes back a long way. This is a hideous... Oh, no. Promised I wouldn't say that. I don't like this carpet. I'm sorry. I think it's hideous. But that is just my personal thing. It's in the V&A. It's dated 1909. It's Persian. And it's copying a Watteau painting, which is in the National Gallery in Edinburgh, in Scotland. And it just shows what you can do with a chart. You can do anything. They have... made some of the things Persian, so some of the instruments being played here are Persian and not French, and bits of the architecture have been changed to make them more Persian. But that is an absolutely perfect carpet. That has 1,122 asymmetrical knots per square inch. I can't even see 1,122 knots in a square inch. We needed an immensely powerful magnifying glass to do the analysis of this. It is superb. I don't like it, but it is a superb carpet. And when you begin to look, everything is in proportion. That corner there is an identical mirror image of the corner here. And again here and here. Because the designer was working with paper, he could make everything fit perfectly within the borders. And he could do whatever design he wanted. And this is another one. This is the salt. It's called the Salting carpet. It's in the V&A. It used to belong to a man called Salting. And there's controversy about this and similar carpets. Are they 16th century? Are they 19th century? Are they Turkish? Are they Persian? It's an ongoing thing at the moment. But this again, you may notice this is where the detail of the metal thread, the silver and the gold came from. And also this is a detail I showed you earlier of the rather sick looking parrots. 700 knots per square inch. Beautiful carpet. Fantastic. But I don't like it. Doesn't do anything for me. It's too perfect. So we'll look at some carpets that aren't perfect. Caucasian carpet from about the 1870s, 1880s, and I know because the museum acquired it in something like 1884 when it was new. So we do know the dates for these. You look at this and it's a lovely carpet. Something odd, they ran out of space as they were working it. They hadn't planned the pattern properly. You have lozenges. And then suddenly, oh, we're running out of space, so we can't fit in another lozenge. Now, if they'd been working from squared paper, a chart, they would have known the total length of their carpet. They would have altered the proportions of the design. These people were probably working from a drawing. And so you can begin to see with carpets like this that are less than perfect, the thought processes the weavers were doing. Panic as they begin to run out of warp and they know they've got to put the borders across. They're having to do it halfway through a motif and it doesn't matter. It doesn't disfigure the carpet. That's perfect. This is simply the way they weave their carpets. the traditions that they have. This is similar, very beautiful carpet. If you look at the size of this and the size of that, again, slight panic as they're getting towards the top and they're thinking, we've got to do another one, and so we're just going to have to make it slightly wonky and it will fit in. And I think these are fantastic because you can see the people behind it. You know these were made by real people who had bad days. And that's wonderful. I can relate to that. These are great. Now, this prayer carpet is similar to the two here on display from the Palazzo Falzon. If you look at the bottom, I said all you needed was a little band of plain weave. These have gone to an immense amount of trouble to weave very detailed decorative bands before they come to the knotted pile. Usually these are tribal carpets. And usually they are woven for a local market. If you're weaving for export, people in Western Europe and North America do not expect to see this sort of thing on a carpet. So I think the implication is these were woven either for their own use or for a very local market that knows that this sort of very decorative weaving, which takes a long time, is an essential part of the object. These are called prayer carpets because of the niche here. And if you are a Muslim, it is important that you pray on something that is clean. And so it's usually a cloth or a carpet. Sometimes they were used as wall hangings. Please don't assume that every carpet that we call a prayer carpet was designed for use. It's become really just a term for that particular design that has a pointed niche or an arch-shaped niche, or in the case of these, a rectangular niche. Interesting that this bit of the carpet is narrower than the bit with pile, and it's because the knots bulk out the warp threads. So you will often find a carpet that's got a decorative band top or bottom is narrower there than it is once you start to knot wool around the warp threads. You automatically increase its width a little. This is another prayer carpet, similar to the ones here. It's got this sort of rectangular niche. And again, you can see quite an elaborate decorative band there. It isn't, the sides and top don't form right angles, so this was woven. It wasn't woven on a milled timber loom or a metal loom. It was woven on something more rustic, really. A limited palette. Generally, the greater the number of colours you have in your carpet, the greater the chance it's from some big commercial workshop in a large urban centre, because they then have access to lots of dyes. You go to the dye merchant down the road and you can buy 20 colours. If you're in a small village, a rural area, a nomadic tribe, you have a limited number of colours available. And the skill of a great carpet designer, and the designer may be the same as the weaver, is to disguise the fact you've only got a few colours. And in this carpet here, it's the same motif throughout the field. And yet, by varying the colours, they're making it much more interesting. And this is something I don't think anybody's really looked at, is the use of colour in Oriental carpets. This is another one, this is Turkish. This, we think, is 17th century, and it seems to be copying an embroidery design, which is really quite unusual for a carpet to copy an embroidery design. But nobody's really done any research. If anybody wants to do research on the relationship between embroidery design and carpet design in 17th century Turkey, it's wide open for you. Again, same motif, but by using the colours, you're creating diagonal stripes. And again, the use of colour, Oriental carpets, really nobody has looked at this at all. Same here. Same motif over and over again, but it looks interesting, it looks more complicated than it is. And again, I tried to find a carpet from near here. This is Tunisia, it's as near as I could get. they've made this interesting simply by using lots and lots of different patterns to make lots of borders. It looks more complicated. When you look at each pattern, it's actually quite a simple repeating one. But by putting lots of it together, you're creating a really fascinating design. I have just a couple more to show you. My favourite, one of my favourites, a Persian carpet. That pattern is called a bote. In England, we often call it a paisley motif because it was found on paisley shawls in the 19th century. It's still a very popular motif in textile designing. These are called pregnant botes because you get a large one with lots of small ones inside. But I wanted to show you this because I hope you can see along here is a seam. And then you begin to look down here and something odd is happening. When you look at carpets, please do be aware that some of them have been cut up and rejoined. Worn pieces have been cut out and the whole thing put back together again. So it's always worth turning a carpet over, looking on the back. You may see some of the seams. You may feel them. Sometimes you can't see them. Run your fingers over the carpet. You may find where something has been expertly patched or repaired. If you look at the design and you see something that looks as if it's not continuing properly, it's been disrupted, again, look carefully because it might have been seamed or repaired. And this is a fine tribal carpet from Iran, similar to some in the Palazzo Falzon, which I'm delighted it has got. These are lovely because the weavers had the basic pattern they were doing. They were doing three medallions. But then the weaver on this side was filling it all with lots of different motifs from the weaver on that side. Sometimes they would do the same thing. So you get a tree there and a tree there. Other times they just did their own thing. One was doing octagons, one was doing hexagons, one did squares. One thought, wouldn't it be fun to stick this in here? These are fascinating carpets. The more you look at them, the more you see. And my favourite bit is an animal. Now, is it there? It's got six legs. This one, I think, has got five, but that one's definitely got six. It's fun seeing things like this on carpet. That's the fun of the tribal carpets. Even if they were made for, even if a merchant came and said, look, I'll come back in 3 months and buy whatever you've woven. They are vibrant, they are lively, they are creative, they're great. Right, last one now. I said, remember the border on the Pazaric carpet, the reindeer, the men on horseback. This is a weaver in Turkey weaving a copy of the Pazaric carpet. So, be aware if you're just judging a carpet by its design. When you're talking about the 20th century, it all gets terribly mixed up. It's not possible to say, oh, look at that, that is a Persian carpet. That is a Persian design, but please be careful, it may not be a Persian carpet. After the Shah was deposed in Iran, the Americans had an embargo and you could not import anything manufactured in Iran. And so you couldn't import Persian carpets into the United States. So workshops in Egypt began to weave Persian designs, and you could of course import an Egyptian carpet into the United States, and it was a Persian design. So this is all commerce. In Turkey, the weavers there are making copies of the Pazaric carpet. So please, you know, it isn't as simple as thinking Persian design made in Persia. Before I went to work in the V&A, I bought a book in a book sale. It was very cheap. It was about Oriental carpets. And I thought all I had to do was to learn everything in the book and I would know everything about Oriental carpets and I would become an expert in no time. And as the years went by, I suddenly realized it isn't as simple as that. It can be very complicated. And I found that if I read one book, it said one thing, and if I read another book, it said completely the opposite. And I didn't know who to believe. And for about 10 years, I would not work with Oriental carpets in the museum. I said no. because I felt excluded. It was as if they were talking a language I couldn't understand. They were breaking everything down into minute details. This comes from this tribe, but it comes from this tribe when they are in their winter pasture. And when they're in their summer pasture, they weave something slightly different. And I thought, well, hang on, how do you know? And so I had no confidence. I thought, I don't want to touch Oriental carpets, they're too scary. And it was really, because I was told I had to, but it was only by beginning with the basics and trying to understand the technique that I became more confident. And I don't want any of you to be put off. If you like Oriental carpets, go for it. Find out as much as you can or as much as you are happy to. Do not let anybody put you off. If anybody starts to make it too complicated, too technical, ignore them. Do your own thing. It comes down to one thing. What sort of knot were they weaving? If they were using a symmetrical knot, they cannot do those curvilinear, natural-looking carpets. You're stuck with the abstract ones, the diagonal lines, the straight lines. It's as simple as that. You can change the design you're weaving more easily than you can change the technique you have been brought up to weave. So the technique is the key. And so, final slide. My email address. As I say, I have some business cards with me. If you want to make a note, I know what it's like. I mean, if there are some questions, I'll try to answer. But you're going for a walk in a month's time, and you suddenly think, ah, I wish I'd have asked. Give me an email, send me an email, and I will do the best I can. And I see I've talked for an hour, which was longer than I meant to, but I did warn you anything could happen. It's all fitness. Yes, please. I'm here in Malta because I've been working, looking at the carpet collection in the Palazzo Falzon. And I knew from photos that had been sent to me that, number one, it's a large one. Do you know there are 80 carpets there? Well, the V&A has only got 800 Oriental carpets. So the Palazzo with 80 is a tenth the size of the V&A, which is massive and global. So you have here in Malta a really important resource. I've taken notes on them. I need to go back tomorrow and do some work on it. But I'm struck by a couple of things. There's hardly any Turkish carpets. There are one, there might be two. And I thought, given the proximity of Turkey to the Mediterranean, there would be more Turkish carpets. But no, most of them are Caucasian and Persian. And within that, most of them have these idiosyncrasies, these sort of weird things happening that make me think that the weavers came from a very strong tribal tradition. At the moment, I can't say whether they're definitely tribal carpets, but that seems to be the implication. And they're late 19th, mainly early 20th century ones, which at first, when you're used to working in a museum where if it's not 16th or 17th century, it's modern, a carpet that is late 19th century, early 20th, tend to be a bit dismissive, I'm afraid. But when you stop to think, hang on, how many textiles do you have that are 100 years old? Not many. They simply do not survive. They get worn. I mean, either you buy something and you put it away, or you use them. And obviously in the Palazzo, they were used as furnishings, and some of them have been repaired. Well, that's part of their life, their history. That's fascinating. The fact that things have survived for 100 years, 120, 130 years, is amazing. And there, something that I don't understand yet. You know, I said with the weft, usually with a carpet, it's a row of knots and then two shoots of weft. A lot of the carpets in the Palazzo only have one shoot of weft. And this again makes me think this is coming from a tribal tradition. So it's actually very intriguing. And I'm grateful to have been allowed to see them. They are magnificent, and if you don't know the palazzo, go along and see it. There's information at the back for those of you who live here to become a friend of the Palazzo Falzon. And also, if you want to become a volunteer, there's information about that. Because, as Francesca said, I am technically an honorary research fellow in the V&A, which really means I'm a volunteer, but they've persuaded me to catalogue a collection and to write a book about it. So I know from experience volunteers are incredibly important. And if you do volunteer, it's a fantastic opportunity to learn about things. I talk a lot, I am sorry. Are there any more questions? Yes, please.
You have mentioned copies coming from Turkey,
yes,
in the 17th century.
Yeah.
And you also now just mentioned that you think that Turkish copies are not sort of, you don't find them authentic copies anymore.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, because I just have just finished a repair.
Huh?
With a 140-year-old copy.
Wonderful.
It belongs to one of the most prominent churches in the world.
Ah, now that's, yes.
And these type of copies, they imported 340 years ago, they imported 24 of these copies.
That's amazing.
Funny enough, they were not sure, you know, about the history of these copies, and now you're confirming that they are 17th century.
Yes.
And one of these copies, I'm very sorry to say that they've been neglected, but one of these copies, which is in the church at Gargou, I saw it last year when they celebrated, you know, the feast, and they put it for only 3 days.
Yes.
And when I saw it, it is as, you know, it looks as if it was, you know, 1 year old.
Churches are a very important source of, because carpets in churches were used on the steps of the altar. You often find in churches some really incredibly important carpets.
6 meters by 4.5.
It's enormous, isn't it? At first, if I'm sorry, you walk out by all means, because I'll just go, just a few minutes. Until about the 1860s, nobody actually started to think that old carpets had survived. And it was in Italy, the churches began to dispose of old carpets. And scholars suddenly began to realise, hang on, this is the sort of carpet depicted in a 15th century painting. And that's how they began to realise that old carpets had survived. It was because of the churches. They had kept them, of course, because they were special. So the churches are a very important source of information. Thank you for pointing that out. It's amazing. Yes, please.
How are you so sure that the carpets were machine-made or...
It's partly the design, and partly when you look very carefully at the paintings, you can see that the patterns are made to go into alcoves. So you start off with a room and you say, this is my room, I want carpeting. But a very good question. But when you do begin to, you also find they're very European designs, they're neoclassical designs to fit in with the contemporary decor. And the colours are on. When you do begin to look at these paintings, you think, hello, this is not an oriental carpet. I'm going to be quiet now, but as I say, got some business cards, take a note of the thing, and please, I'm really sincere about this, do contact me at any time in the future. If I can't help, I'll tell you. If I can, I will help. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Jennifer, for a wonderful lecture. It was so interesting. And thank you all for your attention, and thanks for coming along. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falzon Historic House Museum in conjunction with Fondazione Patrimonio Malti, entitled Oriental Carpets, Their Design and Construction. The talk was delivered by published author and Oriental carpet expert, Ms. Jennifer Worden.